This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
I knew you'd come.
See, Mr. Phillips.
Welcome to our new condition of the hard-traveling fanboys. In this edition, we will be doing a special edition review of the movie known as The Suicide Squad. Senor Duke, welcome to our festivity.
Very good, Mr. Phillips.
Shall you continue?
Very good, Mr. Phillips.
Splendid. As you can tell, we're having a wonderful final deletion time here in our fabulous studios in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Welcome to another edition as I slowly morph from my accent back into my normal accent here in Alabama. Now, I'm talking about two things today, the Suicide Squad and other shit. First, we're going to start with the other shit. And what we're going to start with, ladies and gentlemen, is truly worthy of the term other shit. Because we're going to start by doing our little one-topic rundown for you. Not much else is going on in the world of comics. We got a story about Gotham, your favorite show and ours.
Gotham, if you will.
Yes, Gotham. And we do Gotham. We got beef, in fact, with...
We always have beef with this show.
With this.
Because after all, hashtag Gotham sucks.
Gotham sucks, that's right. Now... A few months ago, it was announced that the character of Poison Ivy had been recast on the show. As you may know, Gotham went with the, well, quite frankly, somewhat unique decision, creatively, to cast a young girl as Ivy Pepper, who, of course, would one day go on to become the villain known as... Wait for it. Pamela Isley.
No, she'll never be known as Pamela Isley.
That's
no.
Right.
She'll only be known as Poison Ivy and Ivy Pepper. Because in the Gotham universe, you have to be your name has to actually be whatever your super villain name is. Like for example, instead of Jonathan Crane, it's Jonathan Scarecrow.
And the Joker, who they haven't revealed yet, is just going to be John Joker.
Or Joker.
Right, exactly. It's always going to... Yeah, P.N. Gwynn, I believe, is
yes,
actually going to be
Gwynn.
Revealed to be Oswald Capelput's real name.
Exactly. And in that process, his father will be revealed not to be a Capelput, like we've been led to believe, but instead to be Commodore Schmidlap.
Commodore Schmidlap. Yes. Anyway, so this little girl version of Poison Ivy is no more. Replaced by a... rather buxom young lady who will be playing the aged Poison Ivy. Now, at first, as you may recall, I thought perhaps this is their way to write themselves out of the stupidity of the name Ivy Pepper, reveal her to be a red herring, and introduce Pamela Isley. Well, of course, that wasn't the case because that would be too simple. So, Nick, tell the audience exactly what Gotham is going to be doing instead.
Well, according to a synopsis that was released and a little bit of reporting from Bleeding Cool, and yeah, I know Bleeding Cool isn't the greatest comic site out there, but, you know, a story about a shitty show deserves a shitty bit of reporting on it, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And thus, what Bleeding Cool is saying is going to happen is, after season 2 of Gotham, which neither Greg nor myself watched any of, or at least I don't think you did
I watched one episode.
Anyway, apparently one of the major plots in Season 2 was Dr. Hugo Strange doing some experiments at a facility known as Indian Hill, which resulted in the rebirth, of Jada Pinkett Smith's Fish Mooney, after laid off in Season 1. Well, apparently a similar experiment is going to result in the young Ivy Pepper aging herself into a young woman who is now going to have her full standard Poison Ivy powers. Thus, she is going to be a 12-year-old in the body of a 24 or 25-year-old. Which, of course, I mean, Greg, and I think you know where I'm going with this, opens the door for the perfect entry point to the rest of the DC universe. If we're going to have a 12-year-old and a 24-year-old body, there's only one DC character we need to bring in, and that, of course, Jordan.
Oh, yes. Because if there's one thing that Hal Jordan loves, it's fighting fear. But if there's another thing that Hal Jordan loves, it's really creepy relationships with underage alien women.
Woo! So, but in any event, there anyway, some kind of wacky medical experiment is going to age up this version of Poison Ivy, and this show's done a lot of stupid things, Greg. This is among the stupidest, in my opinion.
Yeah. So once again, we get another villain who's physically older than our lead character, Mr. Bruce Wayne, who isn't going to have any villain younger than him, apparently. It's just, you know, he's just going to have a bunch of old people that he's fighting, which that's fine, I suppose. It's going to make it really creepy, though, when she, you know, inevitably tries to seduce Bruce when he's, like, you know, 17, 18, whatever, and she'll be in her, I guess, by then, in her late 20s, early 30s. But, you know, to each their own, right? It's just not a good idea. I mean, it's a show like Gotham that seems to perpetually put out strange, on-the-nose, ill-thought-out ideas. But that's just the show in a nutshell, I think. How soon will it be before we start getting an aged-up Catwoman from Selina, or, dare I say it, an extension on Bruce Wayne that ages him? But not to become Batman, just become an older Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, I don't know, man. And plus, they're also doing a deal this season where the producers and even Ben McKenzie himself are threatening, quote, major status quo changes for Jim Gordon. So, I at this point, I think the show has just lost sight of so much that makes these characters who these characters are, you know?
Yeah.
So at this point, you know, I have no real interest in ever going back. I may check out a couple episodes for some hate watching once the whole thing's wrapped up, but they long ago lost me as a regular viewer.
And this may be, in fact, the first recorded sneeze in Hard Traveling Fanboys history. So,
which is kind of remarkable that we made it almost 4 months out of sneeze on air.
That's right, and that's from two people who constantly forget to hit the mute button, ladies and gentlemen. So, you know, I like to think that we have pretty good physical discipline, which, as if you've ever seen us in real life, you'd know is absolutely the case.
Well, we build our physical discipline by working out, and whenever we take our reps, we always are sure to do so
at a
pace that's not quite fast, but not slow either.
Right? Somewhere in between the two. Right?
Yeah.
But then again, exactly. That's just what some might say. You know,
some might say that. Others might not. Right. Others might call it quite a fast pace. You know,
it's not for us to say. Quite frankly, that's your opinion, folks. You have a right to it. Quite frankly, some Richard on Twitter might feel that this show hasn't been lit lately, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I got news for you. We've been lit. Since day one, we've been lit, for God's sake. But I digress. That's neither here nor there. Now, ladies and gentlemen, our next topic of order is reading and watching. What you reading? What you...
Well, partner, as it turns out, I'm seeing here on the Ho Ho Loon ticker that Ho Ho Loon is still alive in the WWE Cruiserweight Classic, First Down 10.
Curiouser and?
And?
Curiouser.
Curiouser.
Now,
no flags.
No flags. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Ho-Ho Loon still alive in the Cruiserweight Classic Tournament, despite the efforts of that foul, stinky, sniveling, snot-nosed, nasty, wart-infested Noam Dar.
The Noam Dar worse than the Chris Brown mother, the dead dog shit percent 1000.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Could not have said it better myself. Well, this has been your Ho-Ho Loon Cruiserweight Classic update. And now back to your regularly scheduled hard-traveling fanboys program. So anyways, ladies and gentlemen, that's when I said there is no way that Parallax could ever beat the Anti-Monitor one-on-one.
Agreed, because, you know, then the Anti-Monitor.
And the Monitor. Yes. So, ladies, that brings us to our usual reading and watching segment of the show. Well, as you know, Preacher is no longer on the air, and not that it's been canceled, but it is no longer, you know, in its current season. So we don't have anything we're watching right now comic book related. We did, however, go and watch a movie, which is the movie we'll get to later in this program, Suicide Squad, but that's for later. Now, on to our reading segment, and once again, stop me if you've heard this before, I have to provide a caveat. Because unlike my unlike my bald amigo here, Mr. Duke, I have not had the opportunity to even purchase my comics from last week due to some out-of-town traveling that I've done over the course of the last 2 weeks. I have not had time to swing by the shop. I have not had money to do so either. So I have been going through my stack from 2 weeks ago. So I do have comics to talk about, but I am just going to be ranking what I've read in the last week, which is mostly comics that came out 2 weeks ago, if that makes sense. So our lists are not going to coincide whatsoever, essentially. But that being said, you guys know the deal. Let's start it off with what we're reading. We're going to start off with our number three book of the week. And Nick, I'm going to start with you.
You know, I'll have to be brief on most of these because you haven't read them and I don't want to spoil anything. But at number three, I'm going to go with Batman number four. And I will say simply, I think this is the best issue of Batman thus far in the Rebirth era. I think it provides you with an interesting look at the characters of Gotham and Gotham Girl and provides a very intriguing angle for what we all knew was coming, and that's a conflict between Batman and Gotham. And, Greg, I know when you finally read the issue, you will be pleased to see that a certain classic DC villain plays a major role in this particular issue.
Hmm. Curious. I am looking forward to it. At my number three spot, I am going to go with a book that was referenced by you in your quick hits last week, and that would be Titans number one by Dan Abnett and Brett Booth. And this was a really good start to this series. Picks up nicely from the Rebirth issue. We continue to focus on Wally West, which is a great move because he's the most interesting part right now of this team. He's been out of the public eye for so long. And what really won me over on this issue was the fact that Linda Park is not being forgotten. I was so worried that they were just going to go with a younger version of Wally that had never met Linda in this reality. And instead, he not only remembers her, he still loves her. And part of this story and this book is going to be the team and he trying to track her down and make her understand what's going on and see how she fits in this puzzle. And likewise, at the same time, she's trying to find Wally, but for different reasons, to try to get her news story out that she wants on her website. And I just think that's a great twist. I think it's clear where this is all going. They are going to reunite. I'm still a little bummed about the kids being gone, but I get it, and I'm not going to complain because I'm getting Wally and Linda back. So, a thumbs up for that.
There are worse fates to befall kids. Just ask the title character of my number two book of the week. See this? Look at this. Look at that transition, Greg. Doesn't think you know where you're going. My number two book of the week is, of course, Aquaman! Number four.
Riding his noble seahorse!
Mourning the loss of his infant son. No, Aquaman, number four, continues the angle of looking at Aquaman as a political head of state, something you and I have both referenced, you know, in the previous issue of the series, and something that you and I have both very much appreciated. That continues. We get more great Mira moments here, and this book just continues to blow me away with how good it is. Aquaman and Green Arrow, as I've said before, are the top books of Rebirth thus far, in my opinion. You know, and that's just one man's opinion. But I would say at this point, Aquaman has the slightest of edges as the overall book of Rebirth so far. So look forward to talking about this one with you more after you've had a chance to read it. But I think you will be very pleased with this issue, to say the least.
Very good, Mr. Lau. And that sets up my number two book of the week, which of course is Action Comics number 960, a book that was referenced also by Mr. Duke last week. And this book continues the title, basically, of the book, Action Comics. This is an action-oriented comic book. We're in the midst of a massive knockdown, drag-out fight between Superman and Doomsday. Originally, it was Superman and Lex versus Doomsday, but it looks like Lex is kind of being forcibly shoved into a more passive role, and Wonder Woman steps in this issue to kind of help Clark out and see if they can put a dent in Doomsday's destructive rampage, which is very reminiscent of his original destructive rampage back in 92. Very good book, very good dialogue, very good art from Tyler Kirkham. Particularly, I enjoyed the writing between Diana and Clark and Lois, which you talked about last week, Nick. The idea that even Diana acknowledges that Lois and Clark together just feels true, as she says. I also enjoy that Dan Jurgens clearly talked with Greg Rucka, as he mentioned on Twitter, about writing Diana, because she reads the same here as she does in her solo title, which is key. Just an enjoyable title. I continue to enjoy both of these Superman books so much. So that's my number two book of the week.
Moving on to my number one book of the week, and this is one I'll talk a little bit more in depth about, because I think it's a book you're probably never going to read. It's actually a Marvel book this week, and it is The Invincible Iron Man number 12. This book's been going on for a while, since the end of Secret Wars. It was one of the first books to relaunch after Secret Wars ended. Written by Brian Michael Bendis, of course, who is probably my favorite Marvel writer of the moment. And what I loved about this book is, really, for 11 issues, Invincible Iron Man has been a very good action-oriented story. And it's been good. It's been a model of consistency. There hasn't been a bad issue of the book yet. But I think we all would agree, regardless of how much you like Bendis, I think we all agree that his strong suit, is writing dialogue. And this is the first issue of the book that is almost entirely dialogue-driven. I don't think there's a single punch thrown in this book. And so Bendis gets to really crank his way into the dialogue, and the result is the most Robert Downey Jr. sounding comic in my head that I've ever read featuring Iron Man. I can't help but read this and hear RDJ in my head, and I'll give you one exchange in particular. The recent story had Iron Man missing in Japan for an extended period of time. And they introduced a character on his board of directors who was seeking to wrest control of the company away from him in his absence. And so when Tony comes back, you know, this character and the rest of the board is there, and they angrily confront Tony. And the guy says, Tony, can't just come back like this and think everything's going to be fine. I assure you, this will be put to a vote. And he's like, well, I got a vote for you. How about we all vote on whether or not we think you're a dick? Show of hands. And Tony and his AI Friday are the only ones who raise their hands. And Tony looks around and goes, well, later on when we take the anonymous vote, I assure you the results will be much different. And it's just like that kind of stuff reads like RDJ. I mean, it's absolutely pitch perfect in my mind. Some of the best dialogue Bendis has written in a long time. And that covers a lot of ground because I'm a big fan of his dialogue typically. So for Bendis's dialogue alone, and I'll give a little shout out to, they're doing a really good job of making this Riri Williams an interesting character before she takes over the book. For those two things, Invincible Iron Man number 12 is my book of the week.
Very good. Very good. That sounds intriguing, actually. You know, that's been one of my big complaints, I suppose, about Iron Man comics is every time I try to pick up an Iron Man comic, it never reads like RDJ because perhaps the people writing the Iron Man comics have not been as funny as he is, I guess. But that's good to hear that's the dialogue that's being written by Bendis, that he's man to tap into the spirit of what RDJ has done to that character, which is really, you and I have talked about how he redefined that character for us and made that character interesting. So you might as well tap into that personality as best you can. Good to hear that he's doing
that. You're right. And we've talked about that. We've talked about that extensively. And in just a few weeks' time, we'll be talking about it even more.
Indeed. In our review of course, Iron Man.
Iron Man.
So that leads to my number one book of the week, of my week, again, not the week, but my week, which would be Wonder Woman number 3 by Greg Rucka and Liam Sharp. This was excellent. This is one of the best comic books in the Rebirth Initiative, in my opinion. Outstanding. The writing, sharp, no pun intended. The art, sharp, pun intended. And just can't say enough about how this is going. I was one of those people who, after the first two issues and the Rebirth issue, I was getting a little impatient, I have to admit. I enjoyed them, but I was waiting for something to really grab me. This was the issue that really grabbed me.
Which is interesting because there's still not a whole lot that actually happens.
No.
It's still very much in a setup period.
Right. Agreed.
Because you have to understand that this is even if you count the Rebirth issue as a part of this story, of the odd issue story, as I'm going to call it, for lack of a better term, this is still only the third issue, and it feels like they're doing a lot of setup still. So
definitely
interesting that you enjoyed this one as much as you did.
Yeah, it's a slow burn comic, but boy, oh boy, is it a good slow burn. What got me were the emotions in the scenes between Cheetah and Diana in this one. The art from Liam Sharp, especially the art, but writing as well from Greg Rucka. It was really emotional. Like, it was some of the most moving comic book art that I've seen in a while.
Yeah, and it's especially weird for a character like Cheetah, who my limited exposure to her in comics has always been as a one-note cackling villain.
Right, exactly. You know, doing like, basically like 60s Catwoman, you know?
Yes, and so, you know, the fact that they're taking her so seriously and almost reinventing her, it feels almost Jeff Johnsian in a way.
Right.
If that makes
sense.
I
agree.
So
I couldn't agree more. So let's go to our worst comics of the week or our low point of the week. I'm going to go first on this one because I didn't read as many comics, so I don't have as much to choose from. And quite honestly, I'd love to plead the fifth on this one and not even nominate a book, because this book that I'm about to talk about, I did like. I thought it was creative and interesting, but it wasn't as good as the other three books that I read. So my pick for worst of the week is Harley Quinn and the Suicide Squad Special Edition number 1, which was a free comic book, actually, that I picked up at the shop. And it's written by, what is the guy's name? The writer of the comic, Williams.
Rob
Williams. That's a very simple name that I should have known. And art by Jim Lee and Sean Galloway in a certain really creative section. The Jim Lee art, spectacular, as you would expect. My favorite superhero artist. Nobody draws Harley like him, in my opinion. He's my favorite Harley artist, too. But there's this really fun little cartoon bit in the middle that turns into almost like a Looney Tunes style of drawing. And it's actually really fun and really well done because of the nature of Harley. Where this kind of didn't work with me is I didn't love the way that he writes Harley's dialogue. I didn't hear her voice when she was talking, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does.
I heard it, the dialogue was fine, but it didn't sound like Harley to me. And I think that was my biggest issue.
There are certain things that it's difficult to imagine in the voice of Arlene Sorkin, and that's always the voice that you read Harley in,
yep,
I would assume.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But so again, this is a good book, actually. I'd highly recommend picking it up. It's free. There's no reason not to pick it up. It was funny. There was some good stuff that happened in it. But because it didn't really read like Harley to me, I have to knock it down a notch. But hey, I'm always going to get a book that has Jim Lee art in it generally. So That's my point.
You're pretty much going to get any book that's free anyway.
That's true. I even picked up, along those lines, Nick, I haven't read it, but I picked up the free Titan Comics 2016 July through December preview featuring Warhammer 40,000. Why did I pick this up? Because it was free. Do I ever plan on reading it? Probably not. But I did pick it up.
Oh, man. Well, in something of a tangential link between our bottom books of the week, my bottom book of the week is actually Suicide Squad Rebirth number 1. And much like you, I didn't really read any bad books this week, but this book kind of irked me a little bit. And I'll tell you why. Story was fine. Nothing wrong with the story. A very simplistic story. But that's the point of these Rebirth titles, is to provide you with a simple jumping on point, right?
Right.
One of the major issues is that it fell back on one of the things that comics often do that it's very hard to pull off, you know, in my opinion anyway, and make it come off as not hokey or cheesy, in that they made the real-life president of the United States a major character. Yes, Barack Obama features heavily in this Suicide Squad Rebirth issue, and it always just, it feels a little weird whenever that happens to me. But that's not my major complaint with this issue. My major complaint is, Greg, why am I buying a Suicide Squad comic right now?
Because Jim Lee on art.
So, if Jim Lee is not on art, what is my reason to buy a Suicide Squad comic? There is none. Is the answer, for me anyway. That's why I'm interested in Suicide Squad. That's why Suicide Squad's on my pull list, is because DC made the promise of Jim Lee. And so they come out with this Rebirth issue, which should be their big selling point to new readers, and Jim Lee is nowhere to be found. Once you open the pages of the book. That's not a knock on Billy Tan. Billy Tan is a fine artist. I have no real issue with Billy Tan. But he's not Jim Lee.
Is it Billy Tan or is it Philip Tan?
Billy Tan, Philip Tan, who gives a shit? It's not Jim Lee is the point.
Right. That is correct.
It's Philip Tan, by the way. Thank you. So, fine art, serviceable story, but without Jim Lee, this one is on shaky ground to start with, and it's got pretty much another issue to prove it to me because, as we've discussed, to make my pull list, it's incredibly difficult.
How did the Harley Quinn writing go in it?
Not a big fan of that either, honestly. Her dialogue seems exceedingly normal, if that makes sense. Like, it doesn't really read like Harley. It just reads like a generic female character to me. So.
Yep.
But it's also written by Rob Williams, so there you go.
Right. Precisely. Well, that about brings
an end. So, did you have any quick hits?
Oh, quick hits. That's a great point. No quick hits for me. What are your quick hits, sir?
I'll go real fast. I got Green Lanterns number 4. I think this is probably the strongest issue of Green Lantern so far. Finally did something to really impress me because dynamic between Jessica and Simon continues to even be improved from what it has been.
That's what I've heard. Saying yeah, our friend Jennifer Smith said the same.
Yeah, it's starting to ramp up a little bit, so it's starting to... It was never, you know, off my pull list, but it was starting to slide a little bit towards that danger zone, and this issue helped to steady its footing a bit. I got Justice League number 2. Best issue so far, which isn't saying much, considering I was kind of down on the Rebirth issue in the number 1. It's still only a pretty good comic, and it's going to be tough for it to stay. So it bought itself another issue, but it better start doing some very impressive things here to keep a spot on my pull list. I got Superman number 4, which I can't wait for you to read. They do some more stuff with the Eradicator. They do some more stuff with John Kent, including a very, very cool moment where John Kent kind of throws down the proverbial gauntlet against the Eradicator and gets ready to really let loose for the first time in the series. So enjoyed that very much. And then, of course, just missing my top 3 books of the week, Green Arrow number 4, which it advances the story that they've been telling in a very cool way. And sets the stage for a brutal, brutal confrontation between Amico and the Black Canary. So, very excited to see how that plays out going forward.
Wow. Interesting. Can't wait to see that. I'm more excited about seeing that than I am to see how this Vin Diesel and The Rock feud plays out in real life.
Are we assuming that's Vin, by the way?
I just read a story as we were talking. It says that TMZ reports that the individual he was referring to was Vin Diesel. that they have apparently clashed several times on set because of
– For what reason?
Because of decisions that are being made by Vin Diesel as executive producer of the movie.
Oh, my God. For The Rock to slap the taste out of Vin Diesel's whisker biscuit candy ass, my God.
Would be amazing.
It would be amazing, yep.
But I don't know if you knew this, but Vin Diesel does all his own stunts.
Let me tell you something about him. He ain't nothing.
He's 5 foot nothing. He's 100 nothing.
Ring, 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 ring.
Hey, it's nothing. He says he knows you. Oh, I left out the cacao. Sadly.
Cacao.
Damn.
Let The Rock pull out his Palm Pilot. My God, we just aged ourselves. Palm
That's
Pilot.
Right. Hey, we aged ourselves in the name of Hollywood Rock, which is always worth it.
Oh, my God, yeah.
This has been the wrestling diversion on...
Imagine, if you will, Greg, an alternate reality in which heel Austin and Hollywood Rock were the real two-man power trip and got that scrub Triple H out of there. Imagine it. Just imagine.
That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. And imagine, if I want Scott Criscolo, if he's listening out there, to especially imagine it. Imagine how much better it would have been. Anyway.
It would have been so much better.
We're going to go ahead and we're going to take a break really early in our broadcast by our standards. Actually breathing through this one. And when we come back from the break, we're going to hit you up with Suicide Squad. Some news, some notes, and our exclusive review right here on Place to Be Nation Pop. Come back right after these messages and listen, won't you?
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzuto here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation listeners. I am Greg Phillips. With me is Nick Duke. And we are here to talk to you about the latest in the DC Extended Universe series of films. The divisive, often maligned DC Extended Universe. And this film, which opened this past weekend to much financial success and much critical consternation, is Dave Ayer's Suicide Squad.
And you may remember that last week we promised you that the NWO B team would be joining us for a roundtable for this podcast. Well, as you can hear in the background right now, that's actually the old Goldberg theme music. They were right here. We had them right next to us. And damn if Goldberg didn't come in and spear every single one of their asses right out of the ring. So no B team appearance on this week's podcast.
That's right. For those of you who may have followed us back in our measly days of being fledgling columnists here on the site, you may recall that we were fond of making promises on which we couldn't deliver, and this is just one of them.
Well, I mean, it's not our fault that whisker biscuit Bill Goldberg got involved.
It's always his fault. Every time we try to have an enhancement talent on the show, he shows up and spears him. Quite frankly, what's wrong with a time limit draw? Why didn't Goldberg come out here and have a time limit draw with Vincent? That's what I want to know. Why the hell can't
one member that we didn't really have in our NWOB team, if you catch my drift.
I think I do. We didn't have anyone that was wearing a giant belt buckle. So,
but moving on. Suicide Squad. We gathered together, Greg, myself, and a group of our closest friends, gathered together at the Duke compound over the weekend and made a little trip to the theater to catch the Suicide Squad. And,
IMAX.
We did watch it in IMAX. You're right.
Paid $15 for IMAX.
Take advantage of the format. But anyway, we all gathered together Saturday morning. We woke up bright and early for a 10:30 a.m. screening. That's 9:30 Greg's time. And
it was a movie that was made by a studio and seen by us.
We should preface this with, I don't think there are any people, with the exception of perhaps Russell Sellers of Sellers Points, who are more emotionally invested in seeing a successful DC film universe, whatever form that may take, than Greg and myself. We want these movies to be successful. We want to be cheerleaders for these movies. We want to hype these movies up to other people. It doesn't, either one of us take pleasure in having to sit here and point out the things that are wrong with something like the theatrical cut of Batman v Superman, or point out, you know, the issues that DC has had thus far in bringing its universe to the big screen. That's not what we want to do. However, Greg, and I think you'll agree with this, that's what we find ourselves in the very unfortunate position of having to do on this show.
Yeah, we're 1 week removed from a podcast in which we praise the extended edition of Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, which from here on out I will no longer refer to as Dawn of Justice because it's too long to say. We were just praising that extended edition and, however, burying the theatrical cut, which suffered from horrible editing, bad pacing, nonsensical plot.
Well,
here we are, several months after that movie was released, and the Suicide Squad comes out and is affected by bad editing, bad pacing, nonsensical plot, and bad dialogue, and the complete absence of a second act.
Yeah, guys, Folks. I'm one of those people who nine times out of ten, my most positive reaction to a movie is going to be in the immediate moments after I've seen it. And movies typically for me slide a little after I have had time to process them a little bit. I think my first red flag was when, as soon as the credits rolled for Suicide Squad, I said, well, that was okay. And after having a few days to think about it, guys, it's not okay. It's not even kind of okay. It's actually really bad. It is a badly made movie. And that doesn't mean that everything about it is bad, but I'm saying that it's just not successful as a standalone film. It doesn't work. As Greg mentioned, it has no second act. Most of the characters have no real motivation to speak of. The villain, such as it is vaguely defined and doesn't really have a plot that makes sense. If you thought Lex Luthor's plot in the theatrical cut of Batman v Superman was nonsensical, I would love to get your take on what the Enchantress is doing in Suicide Squad.
Yeah, and the Enchantress's weird brother, who's never really defined or given a name, I think, in the course of the movie.
Oh man, it's a train wreck. It's a train wreck of a film.
Folks, it ain't gonna be pretty. It ain't gonna be a Briscoe and Funk. It ain't gonna be no Steamboat and. Steamboat and Saturday.
It is indeed, you know, Bowling Shoe Ugly. Yes. There were no this is awesome chance at the end of this one, man. It was
No. They were more like, well, quite frankly, should have been chance, and maybe you fucked up. You fucked up.
So where do we even start here, Greg?
Well, I think the best place to start is probably, do you want to start with some of the rumors about why we may have ended up with
what we got first, and then we'll come into that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the plot, overall story, the overall the structure of the film, if you will.
So this is a film that tells a story that is probably familiar to a lot of people, given the fact that the squad has been featured on Arrow over the last couple of years pretty prominently. And it's essentially Amanda Waller, head of Argus, a mysterious government agency, makes the determination that in the wake of Superman's death in Batman v Superman and the arrival of Zod in Man of Steel, that the Earth and the United States in particular needs a team of metahumans to serve American interests and act as a deterrent for other metahumans that might arrive on the planet who would seek to do America harm. She gains approval to put together a team of supervillains to accomplish this, forcing them to comply to her will by injecting them with a nanite explosive device in their necks. That's essentially the concept in brief.
Villains forced to do good, or sort of good, with the promise of eventual freedom, or at least not death at the hands of execution from the government. So that's the concept of Suicide Squad ever since the 80s, when John Ostrander kind of renovated the idea of the Suicide Squad from what it had been before. And that's kind of the popular modern take on them. There was actually a great animated movie a few years ago, Batman Assault on Arkham, that is a much better Suicide Squad movie than this one, quite frankly. But anyway, what Nick said is 100% true. The plot is what it is, and or at least that's the premise. The plot is something else, because the movie, and we're not gonna get heavy into spoilers here. The movie,
but honestly, Greg, there's not that much to spoil. Like, if you think about it from a plotting standpoint, if we were to sit down and list every major development in the movie, like if we were to say, all right, here are the 10 most important story beats, I would argue at least 8 of those were probably given away in a trailer.
Yeah. Yep. That's something that I guess I'll go ahead and say, since you brought it up. The trailer has almost all of the funny lines in it. The trailers, I should say, have most of the funny lines, also have most of the important beats in the movie. One of the cool things going into this movie, I was like, boy, these trailers have not revealed anything about the story of this movie. I don't know who the villain is. I don't know what the plot is. But it turns out that's because there really isn't much of a plot.
The basics of it seem to be pretty much this. Dr. June Moon, which is a real comic book name, I know, is a character played by Cara Delevingne, or Delevingne, or however you pronounce her name. And basically what happens to her is she stumbles upon an ancient artifact in a cave that contains the spirit of a being known as the Enchantress. The Enchantress possesses her, and so she is sharing her body with this other entity. Amanda Waller, seeking to control her, uses her lover, Colonel Rick Flagg, as a means of keeping eyes on her and forcing her to join the squad, essentially. Eventually that all goes haywire. The Enchantress is able to resuscitate her brother that no one really mentioned existed until it was convenient in the plot to have another supernatural character introduced. And they go off the rails and start trying to destroy humanity through some giant trash swirling machine in the sky above Midway City.
The plot, as pointed out in a great review by Russell on the PlaceToBeNation.com site, it kind of mirrors Ghostbusters in a weird way, in a way that you wouldn't expect, because pretty much the entire climax of the movie, if you've seen the original Ghostbusters, you've basically seen this. It's almost the same beat for beat, including the unfortunate post-fight thing that happens. But it's the villain is not compelling here. The first 10 minutes of this movie, give or take, plays out like like a series of music videos where they pick the most on-the-nose song you could possibly imagine for each of these characters.
Here's what I want you to do. I want you to go and download, you know, just a generic top hits of the 80s and top hits of the 70s album. I want you to put those two albums on your iPod shuffle, and I want you to hit shuffle. And that's pretty much what the first 30 minutes of this movie is. Just...
Oh, but you have to have a song. You have to make sure you have a song that 100% explains the idea of the character. You know, you have to have the crazy song for Harley Quinn. You have to have the rogue song for Boomerang. You have to have the dangerous song for Deadshot. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's almost like you gave a 17-year-old who works at Hot Topic a video editing program and let them make a movie, and that's your first 10 to 15 minutes.
You gave a 17-year-old who works at Hot Topic who had just smoked a fat-ass joint and watched Guardians of the Galaxy right before sitting down to edit this movie, the video editing software.
Yes, so we get these introductions to these characters, and there's some visually cool moments, and you get to see a pretty awesome cameo by the Flash in particular as he captures Captain Boomerang, which I thought was one of the strong points of the entire movie. And you get to see Batman and Gotham acting like a douche.
Acting like a douche.
And, yes, he follows Deadshot, who is walking his daughter home, and instead of waiting for Deadshot to drop his daughter off to apprehend him, stops him and apprehends him in front of his daughter while saying, "I don't want to do this in front of your daughter."
And if you'll notice, Greg,
in front of his daughter.
The entire time they're having a confrontation, essentially, Batman stands behind Deadshot's daughter.
Yes. Essentially making her a human shield.
Yeah, that scene was problematic for me as well, so I'll agree with you on that. But yeah, you get these little snippets of introductions to these characters and how they were each caught and how they each wound up in Belrev prison and how they wound up on the squad. You also get about, what I'd say, 25 minutes of Amanda Waller eating steak.
Right, which hopefully can be explained. You know, we talked about this after the movie, and perhaps the reason that they focus so long on Amanda Waller eating steak is that that's part of the long form plan of the DC Extended Universe. Perhaps in two or three films' time, with that much steak eaten, it's all part of their plan to make Amanda Waller roughly 400 pounds like she is in the comics.
That's a good point. It could happen. But, you know, we have these scenes where they're introducing the various members of the squad, and eventually she, you know, Waller pulls the Suicide Squad together, and you think, okay, this is a team-building movie, right? They've got the team together now. Now there needs to be a little section of the film where they learn how to work together as a team and before they go off and fight the final battle, right? Nope. We're going straight to the final battle, folks. So much so that when they go into battle and they work as a unit, you're sitting there going, wait a minute, how do they know to work as a unit?
The final battle essentially lasts an hour. And in that hour, they refer to each other randomly, for no reason, as family.
Family and friends.
In fact,
yes.
Harley even says, that's we're family now. That's a horrible Harley impression, by the way.
That sounded more like Arlen Sorkin than Margot Robbie probably did at times.
Harley refers to them as family. They refer to each other as family and friends. They don't
at
know
all.
Each other.
They just met.
They just met each other. And you know, at the most connection you've seen between them is kind of a sexual tension between Deadshot and Harley that they don't follow through on. Spoiler alert, sorry. But it just – there's no reason to believe that these people care for one another. And they don't do enough during the movie to show them growing closer together. And because you don't – what would have helped this movie – is if there had been even just a 15-minute scene of them going on a separate mission before this before this one, of them going out and trying to steal something, like Task Force X or the Suicide Squad often does in the comics. They have to go infiltrate somewhere and steal something, or go out and take on a regular human villain that they are equipped to handle. As opposed to – or just a metahuman that doesn't have magic powers that can defeat them all with ease except when it's not appropriate for the plot.
Yeah. And I mean this – like you said, this final battle that starts in place where the second act of the movie should have been just goes on for the last hour of the movie. And it's – there's no real rise or fall to it. The movie introduces you and then it has all fall once the introductions are out of the way. There is no rise. There is no tension built up. I mean, you're sitting there and you're given no reason to care about any of these characters or any of the consequences that are theoretically on the line in this film.
Right. I saw it described somewhere online as less of a movie and more of a collection of scenes.
I would say it's less of a movie and more of a collection of music videos is the way I would describe it. I mean, because that continues all the way to the end. I mean, it just not a whole lot going on here. And I mean, there are decent moments and there are decent performances in the midst of all this. I think you and I both agree. Sure. And this may be divisive to some because I know the guy catches a lot of shit these days. I thought Will Smith was by far the best performer in the movie.
Absolutely. Not even close. He carried the movie on his shoulders to the point where if whatever he got paid by the studio,
absolutely,
they should double it because he was the glue that was holding this movie together. He was the only guy that popped off the screen every time he was on there.
And you know, part of that is
he did his best at gravitas.
Right, and part of that is the fact that I won't even say he had the best dialogue, but I will say he had the least bad dialogue in the movie because nobody had good dialogue in this film. No one.
No. The only possible exception would be Captain
Boomerang.
That's
true, but Captain Boomerang – and that's another thing. We are sold a movie about the Suicide Squad that, sure, based on the trailers, we knew was going to focus heavily on Harley, but it was a movie that was supposed to be about the squad itself. And essentially, this movie is about Deadshot and Harley Quinn with maybe Colonel Rick Flag, you know, thrown in there as Deadshot.
Deadshot,
yeah. So Deadshot and Harley Quinn, and it's just – there's not a whole lot – I mean – Captain Boomerang has, what, maybe four scenes that he's actually featured in?
True. It's just his scenes stand out because
when he gets the opportunity, but he doesn't have the opportunity often. And this is a fanboyish nitpick, I'll admit, but, like, you're calling him freaking Captain Boomerang. Would it be too much to ask for him to, you know, actually, I don't know, throw a freaking boomerang in the movie? Which only happens, I think, twice that I counted.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let's get into the performances a little bit, because we hit on Will Smith as Deadshot, who excellent. We hit on Captain Boomerang, Jay Courtney, who I thought was really good, and I would love to see him in the Flash movie. I don't know about you.
If we're going to get a Suicide Squad sequel, which I don't know that I even want, but if we are, more Boomerang, less of everything else.
Right. Jay Courtney, very good. Viola Davis, I thought, was a really good
role. I would agree as well. I thought her opening scenes in the restaurant were a little on the nose and went on too long, but other than that, she had one scene in particular when they were extracting her from her bunker in Midway City that I thought was a standout and just pitch-perfect Amanda Waller moment. Just came off like the Amanda Waller we know from the comics.
Yes. And came off over the Amanda Waller from the cartoon with the CCH Pounder version of Amanda Waller. It was very, very good. I agree. She was excellent. I thought I know that you're lower on her than many are. I thought Margot Robbie did a really good job. I thought she embodied Harley. I just don't think the writing.
Yeah, I won't say that she was bad. I thought she was serviceable. I thought she was pretty good. I mean, she was okay. She wasn't bad. She wasn't great. But when you're only getting a pretty good performance and your dialogue is so god awful, there's nothing she could have done there. I mean, like, she was caught between a rock and a hard place before, you know, frame one ever rolled of this film, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair to say. I enjoyed her performance. I thought she had a lot of fun with it and brought the energy that Harley needs. And admittedly, incredibly hot. But, like you said, the dialogue was real bad. The worst part for Harley is her only good lines were in the trailers. And in the movie, there are several more lines that are clearly supposed to get a big laugh that did not get
that's,
a laugh.
That's the problem with a lot of the dialogue here in this film is the problem. I think they thought the movie was funnier than it was. Like, I think when it was being written, David Ayer thought, oh, this will be really funny. And for the most part, like, for a movie that was advertised so heavily around humor, we laughed, what, maybe 6 or 7 times?
Right, and mostly for Deadshot
and Boomerang lines, yes.
And Boomerang, yeah. I mean, the funniest line in the movie, in my opinion, was a line that I've seen comic book fans complaining about online, which was the I'm going to need you to white people that shit.
That was really funny.
that was good. But no, so who else is on the squad? I've already forgotten. Killer, a completely indecipherable Killer Croc who you could barely understand what he was saying.
Some sort of digital effect to make his voice more gravelly to get over the fact that he was a giant beast of a person or whatever. But in doing so, you can't understand anything he says other than probably BET near the end of the movie, which people also had an issue with apparently.
And also, again, has very little to do with the actual movie. You barely see him. He pops up near the end for one important scene, but he doesn't really seem to be much of a member of the team, really. He doesn't do anything. And on top of that, you have who
El
else?
El Diablo.
Is that it? Are those all? El Diablo. Now, this is where I'll give the movie some credit. As far as the serious from the movie, I thought El Diablo's plot was handled the best.
I would tend to agree.
I actually felt for his character. I felt for his character. I thought the performance was good. I don't have too much bad to say about his
plot. I don't either. And I thought it was really cool, and everything was going great until they revealed that he was really just an Incan ghost rider down deep inside with a complete headdress.
Oh, good Lord. The CGI on that scene.
The CGI in general in this movie, dude. When they had the Enchantress transform her costume into something more approximating the classic comic book look, and for whatever reason they chose to CGI the costume, it was Green Lantern level bad, dude. It was so bad.
Yep. Then they took for the climax of the movie, they took a scene that I had just seen in the new Ghostbusters remake and had seen in the original Ghostbusters, the giant light in the middle of the city shooting up towards the sky and creating a vortex or whatever. Just a cheesy, corny effect that I've seen in movies a thousand times.
And
was not invented,
speaking of that,
was not original,
in the plot, they make the Suicide Squad come off like the dumbest motherfuckers alive, because when it's eventually revealed that the giant ball of light in the sky with debris circling around it isn't actually a bomb and is supernatural in nature, it's supposed to be this big revelation to the members of the squad, when any person with any common sense would go, that's not an explosion, and no, it wasn't a bomb. Like, just some weird choices by David Ayer. He was scripting this one.
It's okay, though, because even though it was supernatural in nature, the supernatural villain was still willing to engage them in a martial arts battle for some reason.
Yes, despite her teleportation powers that she never uses to just teleport behind someone. Or her ability to disarm them, and she refuses to disarm them.
Right. Or her ability to, after the fight arbitrarily ends, say, just immediately disarm them of all their weapons and render them useless. Which, why not lead with that next time?
I honestly don't know. I think I know why she chose to not just disarm them to start with. That's because she had a kindred spirit with them, Greg, because after all, they are all bad guys. They're bad guys.
I don't know if you knew this, Nick, but
they're not the good guys. They're the villains.
Heroes.
They're the rogues. They're the rapscallions. And every other word for bad guy you can come up with in the course of the film.
They do
That's
bad
right, because
things.
If you weren't told enough by the trailers that these are bad guys, they're going to remind you at least a dozen times over the course of the movie. And I don't mean remind you through action. I mean they might as well be looking at the screen and winking and saying, but remember, we're the bad guys. Wink.
It's like Gotham. It's like Gotham with the Edward Nygma scenes. God, Nygma, you sure do make a lot of riddles. Riddle, riddle, riddle.
Will Smith, there is, of course, the Peter Griffin, so that's why they call it that moment when he goes, what are we supposed to be? Some kind of Suicide Squad?
Suicide.
Oh.
Yeah, and they also give him the unfortunate, lady, you are
evil.
Which is
played, and what's so dumb is, like, the scene is built around that line to the point where I think David Ayer thought that was, like, some sort of witty one-liner that was going to be this big moment for Deadshot, and I'm going, like, that's the most cheesy, on-the-nose line anybody
especially,
can say in that context.
Especially since, 25, 30 minutes earlier, Deadshot tells Harley with a wink on his face, stay evil, Dollface.
Dollface, because it's 1952, apparently.
Yes. Just very, very strange. Very strange movie. You know what it is? You often like to talk about Well, you also have a certain expression you have about certain movies involving boredom. And I think that you could almost say that this is a bad movie about bad people doing bad things.
Very well done. I'll allow it.
We have not touched on another casting choice, another somewhat unique and controversial casting choice, and that would be Jared Leto's Joker. Mm. The reason we haven't touched on that yet is because he's in the movie for, what would you say, Nick? Maybe 12 minutes, 13
somewhere
minutes
in
or
that,
so?
Somewhere in that vicinity, I would wager, out of an hour and 40 minutes probably, yeah.
And here I feel like we're probably going to get into slight spoiler territory. Nothing major. Like, I don't feel like anything we've said at this point is that big of a spoiler, really. But here's where we're going to get into somewhat of a spoiler, because Joker is not in the movie very much. If you're paying to see this movie for the Joker, which he's been in your defense as a viewer, they have advertised the Joker to be one of the main characters in this movie almost from the get-go. He is not. He is an unimportant side character who is only there to add backstory to Harley Quinn.
And to theoretically put a wrench in the Suicide Squad's plans at a certain point in the movie.
Right. So, let's just cut right to the chase. What did you make of the first live-action adaptation of the Joker since Heath Ledger?
I'm going to break from our Place to Be Nation pop compatriot Russell Sellers here a bit. Russell, I think, has taken the standpoint of, we didn't see enough to make a judgment. And I'll agree that, you know, I'm not willing to write it off entirely, But I am going to make a judgment based on what I did see, and thoroughly unimpressed would be the best way to describe it. He didn't do anything to me to make me take note of his Joker. His Joker was exceedingly average. There was nothing interesting that he brought to the character. And sure, the character wasn't written great, so I don't know how much of that is Jared Leto's fault. But I will say from a performance standpoint, I just sat there going, well, that's a pretty paint-by-the-numbers reading of the Joker. All of the difference and all of the intrigue around the character, the things that set him apart from previous incarnations, come entirely from a character design standpoint, from a costuming standpoint, and from, you know, the standpoint of the way he interacts with Harley Quinn, which that's one thing I'll give them. It's a version of the Joker and Harley Quinn story that I've never seen before and kind of hope I never see again, honestly.
Yep. Let's hold off on that, though, because I also have strong feelings about that. Let's hold off on that because I want to talk about Leto. I kind of come down somewhere in the middle on him because I agree with Russell that we need to see more before I can say how he's going to do as the Joker. But I do agree with you as well that from what we got in this movie, I didn't see anything special about it. For all the hype that it got, for all the marketing that WB put behind it, for all the hype that people on Facebook comment sections had in the days leading up to the movie about how it was going to blow away the previous iterations and all that. Okay, here's the thing. When I think back to the Joker iconic performances, there have been four. Cesar Romero in the 60s. Unique. Brought something to the table. Brought an over-the-top vaudeville-style comedic.
Really set the tone for the way villains were going to be portrayed on that show. Like, he is the template from which every villain in the Batman 66 cloth was cut.
Yep. Jack Nicholson.
Iconic to this day, no matter what anyone tells you.
Yep. Jumps off the screen. A mob boss version of the Joker. The hyena laugh. The just the malevolent Joker that literally is trying to find the joke in everything, even if it's horrendously bad. Mark Hamill, the animated
probably
Joker,
the closest to any of the comic book traditional comic book versions of the Joker. Like, this is the comic book brought to life, in my opinion.
Right, and showed a great range of the character, which started taking cues from Jack's Joker and kind of morphed into more of the comic book take on the Joker, or depending on the version that you're going with from the comics. But he has a menace to him, but he's also really funny. But it's unique. It's different. He brought new elements to the character, almost a stand-up comedy aspect to the character. Heath Ledger from The Dark Knight.
Completely.
That's the other
redefined the character and what the audience expects of him.
Exactly. Different. Brought something genuinely new to the character to completely distinguish himself from Jack, from Caesar, from Mark. The same way those performers differentiated themselves from those that came before them. Leto in this movie, in my opinion, from what I saw, again, not bad. There's nothing about it that I could say was bad, but did not bring anything new to the table. Didn't really scare me. Didn't really make me laugh. Didn't pop off the screen when he was on it. Didn't provide this crazy new take that I thought we were going to get. People were saying, oh, he's going more Killing Joke Joker. More of this, I suppose, comic realistic take on the Joker.
Didn't see
that. I saw what I saw, to be quite honest, was generic.
Yes, I have never seen the Joker played so normally. Like, they've got some bizarre imagery, like the image of him laying in the circle of knives or whatever that's near the beginning of the movie, and they do some other things, like have him dress up in a tuxedo or what have you. But, like, other than that, throughout the movie, he just acts like a, like, if you showed this to a blind Batman fan, you would have a hard time differentiating him from someone like Sal Maroni or Carmine Falcone, in my opinion.
Yeah, the only crazy thing he does in the movie is take the chemical bath with Harley. And that's, you know, part of a montage, and it's not It's a crazy thing to do, but he doesn't. The Joker was written like this in the god awful story Hush Returns. If anyone has ever read that, just a generic mob boss, not crazy, not pretending to be crazy, just a normal mob boss, and it's not an interesting take on the character. And so that's what we got in this movie from Leto. And again, I'm not saying he can't do better. I'm not saying he can't do in a future Batman movie or in a standalone Harley Quinn movie, if that happens, do better. But again, just nothing new was brought to the table here, and I think it was hurt by the hype. Russell and I talked about this the other day, about the massive hype machine behind this movie, which appears to have worked, at least on the opening weekend. But in my opinion, the hype machine got to me because it elevated my expectations of what to expect from Leto's performance to a degree that it couldn't match. Now, to a point you made earlier, the movie, in my opinion, and probably in your opinion, completely misses the point of the Joker and
Absolutely.
Harley relationship.
I have never encountered a version of this relationship where you are supposed to be led to believe that the Joker cares for Harley Quinn just as much as she cares for him. The entire point of these two characters is that the affection is entirely one-sided, that the Joker only keeps her around because he finds her borderline amusing and somebody that he can take advantage of whenever he needs somebody to take advantage of, whether it's for an actual gain or just to take advantage of somebody for the entertainment value of it in his sick and twisted mind. Like, but in this movie,
he drove her insane. Literally drove her insane, drove her to madness. And in the movie, it's presented as if he loves her. He genuinely loves this creation of his, and she genuinely loves him because she doesn't know any better. And that's the traditional – the take that everyone is familiar with of Harley is she's in an abusive relationship. And part of her character journey, part of what has made her such a popular
character, is finding eventually the way to get
years.
Out of an abusive relationship.
Exactly. Exactly. Remember just how satisfying it was in the animated series when she finally got pissed and beat the crap out of the Joker? It was so awesome. She wanted to kill him, and it was like, yes, you wanted her to kill him because she finally realized that she's better than what he treats her as. And you lose that entirely if you have a Joker who genuinely loves Harley. Now, in a future movie, there's a way to write themselves out of that. But what we got in Suicide Squad was pretty obvious to me. They were star-crossed lovers.
Yeah, I mean, that's the take they went with. Why they went with that take, who thought that take was interesting, I don't know. Like,
because, and again, the whole point is, okay, the Suicide Squad is a new family for Harley after she can move on from the Joker. But she's not moved
because
on
she has
from
no,
the Joker.
She has no need to move on from the Joker because their relationship is portrayed as a little weird, but mostly a positive dynamic for her. It makes no sense. Like, I don't know who – it must have been David Ayer. Did he know anything about Harley Quinn before writing this movie? Like, what – what were they thinking? Especially in the context of, okay, so one of the reasons they do a Suicide Squad, I think we all believe, is so that they could introduce a number of villains at one time to help get their universe off the ground. The trade-off right. that comes with that is, because you've gone with an older Batman, you have to work under the assumption that both Harley and the Joker have been fully developed as we know them in this movie anyway, for a little while, for at least like 2 or 3 years, wouldn't you agree? So
yep.
These two not only are in a relationship, she's in a long-term relationship with the Joker that appears to have had no real negative physical consequences for her.
And in fact, on her introductory title card that pops up at the beginning of the movie, it mentions that she took credit for the murder of Robin. Which means that she took the fall for the Joker, presumably, for the killing of whichever Robin it is. We'll say Jason Todd. That's, you know, I can see Harley doing that. Great. That would make sense. That's what her character would do. But based on the movie, I'm like, maybe she actually did help him kill Jason.
You know, that's an interesting point, because there's also a line that Amanda Waller says in the movie that I had a big issue with when she said it. But now in hindsight, maybe I don't, because she says at one point, Harley Quinn, she's crazier than the Joker. And I went, you know, on first hearing it, I was like, oh, that's stupid. Nobody should be presented as crazier than the Joker, and especially not Harley. But given what we saw in this movie, in this universe, from what we've seen, Harley is absolutely crazier than the Joker, because the Joker is just another mob boss, essentially.
Right. And I could even be down with that line if you're going with the take of the Batman idea that, you know, sometimes we've seen comics where Batman's told the Joker, you're not crazy, you just want everybody to think you're crazy. Whereas Harley legitimately is crazy because of what the Joker right. did to her. So I could see that, but it's just it's not a good dynamic. It's actually a bad dynamic. I think it's harmful to the character. Now, I would be interested in seeing Harley in a standalone movie and the Joker in a different movie, but I do not want to see – even though I thought – what did you think about the scene with Batman chasing Harley and Joker? Because I actually loved that scene.
One of the better scenes in the movie.
Yep. Agreed. Thought that was excellent.
And I think that actually had the – like it had the one line from Harley that like when I watched it, I was like, okay, that's Harley Quinn, because it came to me like an animated series line. When Batman stopped the roof of the car and she's firing up through the roof and she's like, Bats, you're ruining date night. And that to me – I don't know. Simple line.
Yeah,
but it sounded like something that would be in the animated series, and that
even the whole sequence when they draw, you know, I'm not going to spoil it for everybody, but there's a sequence that involves Batman and Harley, and it really played true to the character. So I like that. However, I personally don't want to see Batman versus the Joker again in a movie, especially this Joker. And I know there's been talk of that, but I don't want to see another – I don't want to see Joker and Harley versus Batman. I want to see Batman versus people that he hasn't fought in a movie 100 times before. So, you know, if they're going to have them pop up again, Suicide Squad sequel, or do the Harley standalone movie that I think they want to do, which I think would be cool if it were written the right way.
Yeah, at this point, I'm going to withhold judgment on that because, you know, I've only seen one version of this character written in this universe, and I'm not overly impressed either the writing for Joker or Harley, so I'm not even sure if I want that at this point. Honestly, and that's something,
yeah,
that's something
Joker
I wanted to talk about, is like, after this movie and after the theatrical cut of Batman v Superman, I don't even know what I want from the DCEU at this point because they've missed the mark so much. It's just... I am in a complete prove-it mode to me. They have lost all the benefit of all the doubt, which is to contrast where Marvel is at, because, like, as I told you over the weekend, Marvel could put out a trailer that shows me absolutely nothing but, like, 30 seconds of black screen and the Marvel logo, and I'd go, well, you know, I don't know. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. And DC just doesn't have that right now.
Yeah, one last point on the Joker. It feels like a lot of style and not much substance to the character right now.
They came up with
the
controversial
visuals,
look
neons.
First and the character second. You're absolutely right.
So, anyway, but now moving on to your point as a whole, you know, like I said, I think there's great building blocks in the extended edition of Batman v Superman. And I think there were characters in this movie that I want to see again. I want to see Harley again. I want to see Captain Boomerang again. And I especially want to see Deadshot again. That's my biggest fear about this movie, if the box office drops off like it did with Batman v Superman, is that we won't see Will Smith in another DC movie. And I think that would be a shame because he's laid a really good building block for Floyd Lawton here, just in terms
of
performance.
The problem with building blocks being in the ultimate cut of Batman v Superman is that the casual audience will never see those blocks.
And you can't build off of
blocks that you only showed a certain subsection of your audience, you know?
Yep, and I'm with you, Nick. I'm with you because I'm in the same boat now with – both of us think that Wonder Woman's going to be good, correct?
It better be. It better be at this point, is all I'll say.
It looks good. However, I'm on the same boat with you. Prove it. Because my expectations I thought, and I'll be the first to admit this, I thought for months that Suicide Squad was going to be the bomb. I thought this was going to be the – and yes, I just said the bomb because it's 1996. I said months ago I thought the Suicide Squad was going to change the fortunes of the DC Cinematic Universe. You had a critically acclaimed director, a guy who's written – great scripts, legitimately great scripts, and you had a trailer that presented a tone different from anything we've gotten before. I was not prepared for the mess.
I think part of the problem, Greg, is that, and maybe you agree, maybe you don't, there was a, after the first trailer, which people were kind of iffy on, there was a concerted effort on DC's part to market this the same, almost the same exact way that Guardians of the Galaxy was marketed. Would you agree?
In terms of
presenting us with trailers and marketing that sold the movie as being a fun romp that was laden with pop culture references to pop culture, you know, through the musical references, and kind of giving you a somewhat irreverent tone with off the wall characters.
I can sort of agree that. I don't think that the parallels are quite as much as.
Oh, come on, dude! The Bohemian Rhapsody trailer and the Ballroom Blitz trailer both took almost direct parallels from that. From the Hooked on a Feeling Guardians of the Galaxy trailers.
I would agree to an extent. I would agree that, yes, they're using a classic rock song. I didn't think that the tones of the two trailers were exactly the same, personally. I thought the Suicide Squad, by nature of the tone of the film, was kind of presented a little bit differently than Guardians was. But I do agree it was influenced by that. No question it was influenced by it. Absolutely. And I think that, like you said, the Markin focused much more on the comedy aspects than it should have, because that was misleading the audience to expect an actual funny movie, which Guardians was.
And Suicide Squad was not.
Right.
So, it – I don't know. I don't know at this point. It just
I don't think there's anything wrong with using – I love the Bohemian Rhapsody trailer. I think it's the best trailer for any of the movies that DC has put
out.
Right,
that's not my – the trailer itself is not my issue. It is the promise it entails that is my issue.
Right. That's exactly it. Exactly it. Because if you're going to put that trailer out, then by God, you better present a quote-unquote fun, as much as I hate that term, movie. A movie that is irreverent, a movie that doesn't take itself seriously, a movie that acknowledges its cheese – which this movie never did, and those are failures, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Quite frank. Then again, some might disagree.
Some might, but most don't, apparently. So,
well, I don't know. The response among the general audience has been strong, it seems, although critics have not been fond of it, as we were not. One thing that I will give them credit for, nobody can say that Warner Brothers / DC has a diversity issue, because this is the most diverse superhero movie ever made.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah,
it's something that Marvel still has issues with.
But Marvel has taken great steps to address that. What with Black Panther.
Agreed.
And Captain Marvel coming up, Black Widow. So, I mean, it's something that – but that's the difference between the two companies. When Marvel has an issue, as you noted with diversity, rather than attempting to solve it in one fell swoop, they try to build to it. DC seems to think that they can come along and just fix everything out of the blue. You know, just if people have problems with the tone of Batman v Superman, fine. We're going to make a sweeping, generalized change to the way we're handling Suicide Squad.
So, if you can't tell by now, folks, our overall review of this movie is not a good one. I would recommend waiting until this comes out on video to watch. I will never tell somebody not to watch something, because you might like it. You might like it in a way that we didn't. I've talked to several people that have, but. My recommendation, if you were one of my best friends and you were asking me, should I spend $15 to go see this in the theater, I would say no.
Wait for DVD and cross your fingers for some sort of alternate cut. Even though David Ayer says one isn't coming, I still say stranger things have happened. I wouldn't be surprised at all if a different cut of this movie eventually arrives on DVD.
Directors, and especially directors involved in projects like this, say a lot of things. So, like this is going to be a good movie.
this is the movie we wanted to shoot all along.
All along, which let's get into some of the news items that have come out of this. A report came out in Hollywood Reporter that I can't recommend this highly enough. Google Suicide Squad Hollywood Reporter, and it's one of the top articles that comes up. It's a great behind the scenes kind of expose of the creative process behind this movie, and also an expose on the way things currently work in Hollywood, because this is not just an issue for Suicide Squad. Let's say that up front. It's an issue that evidently, according to this article, went on during the filming of Godzilla, goes on during the filming of many, if not most, current Hollywood blockbusters. But I think this also shows why many, if not most, Hollywood blockbusters today are terrible. And this story weaves a story of studio interference, studio involvement, and competing cuts of the same movie. In other words, David Ayer shot a movie, was in the midst of shooting a movie. The feedback for Batman v Superman comes back and is overwhelmingly negative in the theatrical cut. Studio sees the overwhelmingly positive reaction to the trailers, particularly the Bohemian Rhapsody trailer, hires the same group that made that trailer to then go in and take what David Ayer had shot and re-edit it to create their own edit of the movie. They play both versions of the movies for a test audience. The test audience responds more favorably to the new edit that added in allegedly more humor, more quirkiness, things like that. So what we ended up getting on the big screen allegedly was a meeting in the middle of the two edits, but leaning more towards the new edit than the original David Ayer edit. Now, Ayer has said this is the version of the film he wanted to release. The studio has said this is David Ayer's film. But according to this report, there was a lot of consternation that went into this movie. And what I thought was the most damning aspect of the article was the fact that Warner Brothers set this deadline for Suicide Squad, and they were so hell-bent on reaching that deadline that David Ayer had, what, I think 2 weeks to write the movie?
6 weeks, according to this. Yeah.
6 weeks. Sorry, 6 weeks to write the movie. So in the course of 6 weeks, he wrote and finished the movie, the script for this movie, then started filming almost immediately thereafter. Just not a good way to handle a production like this. When you're really trying to still kick off your cinematic universe, because Batman vs. Superman made a lot of money, made more money than Iron Man made, but it was not the success that Iron Man was, if that makes sense. So this, to me, is still – they're still in the Iron Man phase of the cinematic universe. They're still trying to find the big hit movie that works with critics and audiences to really kick off the extended universe, and – you can't give a guy 6 weeks to write the movie and then come in and have competing edits of the movie and not live by your creed, your motto that they had when they started this film division, which is we are a filmmaker's film company. We want auteurs. We want artists to come in and make movies they want to make the same way that we let Christopher Nolan do what he wanted to do on his Batman movies. The same way that we let other directors do in other divisions. But for whatever reason, starting with Green Lantern, with a superhero genre, they just don't do that. They interfere perpetually. Nick, your thoughts on this article?
You know, I wish I could say that it's surprising. I wish I could sit here and, you know, be taken aback by this and be filled with outrage. But Greg, I mean, like you just, the reference you just made is perfect, because with the exception of perhaps the competing cuts, isn't this the same? Like it's almost like a game of Mad Libs, Greg. You could pull out Suicide Squad and replace it with Green Lantern, and replace, you know, David Ayer with Greg Berlanti, you know, who wrote Green Lantern, and it's Green Lantern Part 2 is what it is. It's too many cooks in the kitchen. It's a studio who was never confident in the project from the jump. It's a movie that just was marketed wrong, who had it, that had inflated expectations, and that is the victim of a studio that is in such a hurry to get to where Marvel is right now that they are losing sight of what it took for Marvel to get there. Marvel didn't just, like, wake up one day and say, you know what, we're going to do the Avengers. Like, they had to roll the dice on Iron Man, roll the dice on the Incredible Hulk, roll the dice on Thor and Captain America, B and C list characters, before they had a universe that is where it is today. And Warner Brothers thinks they can just wake up, snap their fingers, and go make $1 billion. And I just, I don't know. I don't know at this point.
And if they don't make $1 billion, they overreact to it. And take it out on everyone else that's making movies.
And this is ultimately my concern. I think you and I both are very cautiously optimistic about what the involvement of Geoff Johns could mean for the DC Extended Universe going forward. The
right.
concern is, how much can Geoff Johns really do if those if the powers that be are, you know, constantly reaching into his kitchen and messing with his ingredients? You know what I mean?
Precisely, because let's say that Suicide Squad tapers off at the box office. Right now it's an overwhelming success, but what if it tapers off at the box office badly, even worse than Batman v Superman? Does the studio then think, oh, well, audiences didn't react to this more irreverent movie. What should we do? Let's look at Wonder Woman and see ways that we can make it different from the previous two. And again, Geoff Johns is my boy. I think he's great. He doesn't have a lot of experience with writing Hollywood movies. So let's say that it stumbles just a little bit. It's good, but not great. Are they then going to panic again that Wonder Woman doesn't make $1 billion at the box office? And then just throw the whole thing out the window? You know, I don't know. I think that there's a lot of unknowns right now with the DC Extended Universe. And it's a scary place to be for a fan, because these are the characters that I have always identified with most, the characters that I love. And it frustrates me that I have so little confidence in what's happening. Again, hopefully, with Geoff in place, they seem to have the right capture of Wonder Woman. But I thought that, based on the Suicide Squad trailers, that they had a good handle on the Suicide Squad characters. And they didn't. So it's really concerning, and I hope, and it looks like Wonder Woman's going to break the curse, but who knows?
I almost feel like the real nightmare scenario is Wonder Woman does well, but then Justice League comes along right behind it, is tepidly received once more, and undoes all the goodwill that Wonder Woman built up, leaving you right back where we are today.
Which is, again, possible. Because we know, and we don't know. I shouldn't say we know. I believe that the studio is going to be heavily involved in
Absolutely.
Justice League.
I don't think there's any question about that. I don't think there's any way to explain why we already have a trailer or why those set visit reports came out so early, other than damage control at a studio level.
And let me tell you what worries me about, because all the stuff we've seen out of that, we talked about this podcast or two ago. All the stuff that came out of that set visit was great and wonderful. But here's the thing. I think that you'll agree with me on this. I'm not sure. If you're a movie studio, if you are a film director, your goal should be to make a good film. What? Your goal should not be to satisfy whatever whims and fancies comic book fans who write on the internet want to see in a particular movie at the expense of whatever movie it is you're trying to make. So, in other words, yes, I've been critical of particularly Batman vs. Superman, the theatrical cut. Yes, I've been critical of some of the decisions that Zack Snyder has made. Here's the thing. If you're going to hire a director, you need to let that director do his thing that you hired him to do, or fire him and get another director that can go commit another movie that you want to do. Don't put – and it's hard for me to say this. I'm not saying that I pity the guy or anything, because he's making tons of money to do this. But and he's choosing to put his name out there. But
I think what you're getting at, it's the same thing I've believed for a little bit. Based on that trailer we've seen of Justice League, it doesn't look bad. It looks okay. Nothing wrong with that trailer. But doesn't it look like they're asking Zack Snyder to do things that he's not exactly – that aren't exactly in his wheelhouse, that aren't exactly his comfort zone?
That he has never tried to do in,
exactly.
in a feature film.
It's the old Paul
not to say that he
it's
can't.
It's the old
it,
Paul Heyman thing, Greg, that you and I have discussed many times before. If you've got a piece of talent, you should always be seeking to accentuate their strengths and hide their weaknesses.
Hide their weaknesses.
It feels like Warner Brothers is not doing that with Zack Snyder. Unfortunately, like, again, I haven't seen enough from Justice League to make a determination, but I'm very worried they're putting him in a position to highlight his weaknesses.
Right, and again, a lot of the stuff that was coming out of these set visits was really promising, but was it really promising because, oh, I bet that's going to be a good movie, or was it promising because, hey, Batman told a joke, or, hey, the Flash looks like he's whimsical and positive, or, hey, it looks like everybody's not gloomy like they were before. Those are all things that matter, certainly. But they're things that matter more to comic book fans than to moviegoers. I think the big key is the movie going to be good? Is the movie going to make sense? Is it going to stand on its own? Because remember, and I hate to keep bringing back this example, but quite frankly, it's the only universally praised DC movie or movies that we've gotten in 30 years, for God's sake, which are the Nolan Batman movies. But in those movies, there were decisions that Chris Nolan made that veered from the comics and that still stick in some people's craw. But you know what? They were better movies because of it.
Absolutely. And to
because he made his decision and did his thing that he wanted to do for his movie and just made a good movie. And that's at this point where I'm at with the DC movies. Forget showing me a specific visual from the comic books where I can say, oh, that's right out of Dark Knight Returns. Awesome. I'll be like, yeah, that's awesome. But I'll also be like, okay, does that fit the movie? Was there any point in that being in
Greg, here's a question for you, and I have an opinion. I want to catch yours. Imagine a world in which Chris Nolan's Batman trilogy comes 10 years later. The Marvel Cinematic Universe has been going for a while. Chris Nolan tries to make Batman Begins in 2015. Do we ever get Batman Begins as we got it in 2005? There's
probably
no
not.
Way.
No.
There's no way.
No.
They would say it was
too grounded, it was too slow, it's too basic, been there, done that, not interesting enough, need to have more characters in it, need to have Superman in it, need to have Wonder Woman
in
it.
You and I have talked for a while about how we are fine with the DC Extended Universe having a different tone and different approach than Marvel. And I think we agree that's
right.
A good thing, ultimately, if that's what they're going to do.
Yes.
I think the problem is, to this point, they haven't really done that. And they haven't done it well. They've tried to.
Nope.
But in doing so, it's almost like the TNA at its worst, WWE, where they're trying to be different, but only so different, if that makes any sense. They're still trying to ape that model as much as they can.
But do it through their weird, like, desaturated filter. Like, you know, just a strange – I don't feel like they have it. I don't feel like they have – there is no guiding direction, it feels like.
And that's what they said was going to be the difference for a while, is that each filmmaker would be allowed to make his film, which, as we know, has not been the case thus far.
Has not been the
case. So at this point – Geoff Johns is there. Maybe we will have a unified vision, a unified direction, finally. I don't know that. I hope so. But at this point, I have no faith. Like, my faith has been spent.
Good thing the comics for DC are delivering right now is all I can say. Good thing the comics are delivering because the movies damn sure are.
And that really should be – theatrical. You know, Greg, that should be really the biggest, I think, damnation of Suicide Squad is that you and I both – to a certain extent, would defend Man of Steel and defend Batman v Superman against people who had issues with the tone and the characterizations.
Absolutely.
But we're at a point where there's no defense left to be made. Like, we can't defend something that DC is giving us no room to defend.
when we saw that ultimate cut, like I said, of Batman v Superman, it made me retroactively hate the theatrical cut. Because the ultimate cut is a cohesive movie, and the theatrical cut is a mess. And now in Suicide Squad, it's so appropriate that you compared it to TNA, because it truly feels as if Vince Russo wrote Suicide
Squad.
Absolutely,
absolutely. Here's another one for you. I got a question. Let's get your opinion on this one. Justice League and Wonder Woman both in production right now. Flash and Aquaman set to come up next.
Right, Flash starts filming in January, I think.
Do either of those movies ever see the light of day?
Yes. I think so.
I'm not so sure.
I'm not. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not 100% confident. When January rolls around and they start filming The Flash, I'll believe that, because they're not going to start filming a movie and then it never get made. That's not going to happen. But Aquaman, I don't know. We'll see. But The Flash, if they get to January and they start filming, I'll believe it. But I understand where you're coming from, because everybody can say, well, it's in pre-production, or, well, it's been official, made official. Green Lantern sequel was made official and never happened, and killed that version of the DC Extended Universe and what was supposed to be. I am not convinced they're not just going to cut bait at some point. I hope they don't.
No,
I hope that all these movies succeed. But Lord Almighty, nothing at this point, nothing is for sure with the DC Extended Universe.
Absolutely nothing. I mean, again, you know, we want to praise, but we just haven't been given a reason to. We don't sit here and take shots out of some internet-driven, you know, need to be snarky and need to sound like the smartest kids in the room.
No.
Because we're certainly not.
No.
But we haven't been given a choice. At this point,
no. I mean, and I will still defend Man of Steel. It's not, again, I am much more on the side that will tend to like a DC property, even if it has its flaws. I mean, hell, even the animated version, I know that you're not a fan of Green Lantern First Flight, and I still defend it, even though it's not as great as it could be. But that's just where we're at right now. Like, it's hard to defend when you see these movies and you see what's becoming of these movies when they come out. Man of Steel, I thought, was a great foundation.
Still, yeah, still is.
And I look at the theatrical version of Batman v Superman. I look at Suicide Squad. I look at the studio's history of overreacting. They overreacted to Man of Steel, for God's sake. They overreacted to Man of Steel getting average reviews, not bad reviews, average reviews, and not, again, making $1 billion freaking dollars at the box office, and they shoehorned Batman into what was supposed to be the Man of Steel sequel. I don't get it. I don't understand it. I think that it's bad for fans of these characters in terms of we have to worry instead of be excited. I'm at a point now where I am just hoping that Wonder Woman doesn't suck, rather than saying, man, it's going to be awesome. I think it, objectively, everything about it looks awesome, but I can't shake that feeling in the back of my head of, what if we're being sold a bill of goods? What if it comes out and it's hacked to shreds like all these other movies have been? You know, and it's not a good place to be for a fan of DC Comics. Meanwhile, with Marvel, it's like, oh, are they going to do a Squirrel Girl movie? You know what? I'll probably go see that.
At this point, you've been given no reason not to see anything Marvel sticks its name in front of. Like, they have succeeded in becoming a brand, an entirely separate brand from their comics. The name Marvel Studios is a mark of quality at this point. I mean, to the level that a lot of other studios have never been before. Like, this is an unprecedented run on their part, and it's clear that Warner Brothers wants DC to be an answer to that, but they aren't allowing them to be.
And we're not, to be clear, because I can hear this criticism coming a mile away, why do you have to compare them? You shouldn't compare them. I agree. We're not coming at it from, this movie sucks because it's not Guardians of the Galaxy. This movie sucks because it's not Avengers. This movie sucks because it's not Thor or what have you. We're coming at it from a comparison in terms of the way that one superhero company is
handling
its characters, and the way the other is handling its characters in terms of their treatment in multimedia aspects and right now, other than TV, TV is the one lone exception right now for DC, and video games, I suppose, as well. But certainly theatrically, Marvel is handing DC its ass right now because there is a competition between the two. Both should – we as fans should want both of them to succeed.
And we do.
But if you don't think there's competition, you're fooling yourself because the people at Warner Brothers damn sure think there's a competition. The people at Marvel don't because they don't have to because they're number one. It's the same philosophy of if you're on top, don't acknowledge the other guy. But the problem is the people at Warner Brothers, and we can speak to this somewhat because we saw it in wrestling. We saw it in wrestling when WCW started paying more attention to what WWF was doing than what they were doing. And what happened?
It fell apart.
It didn't turn out well, for those of you that don't know. It did not turn out well for WCW. So – you know, I'm not saying that obviously DC is in no danger of folding as a company, but these movies, we could be in store before too long for yet another reboot of another DC extended universe.
And
you never know.
The concern is there's only so many times they're going to actually try to reboot the entire universe. Like,
right.
I
we're getting ahead of ourselves. Hopefully Wonder Woman will kick ass. Hopefully Flash and Aquaman will kick ass. But I think that there is more credence now than ever before to the idea that some said a long time ago that we ridiculed at the time, admittedly, that they probably just should have gone the route of doing solo movies before doing team movies or crossover movies. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, I don't even know that it's necessarily a solo movie versus team movie thing. It's just a make consistent movie. Make a movie with a sensical plot. Make a movie with a story that flows logically. It can be done. But they just haven't done it. And it's frustrating at this point. Like, and it's so weird for us to be in a position where the hopes of a fandom are hanging on the back of a character that has never been brought to the big screen before in her own movie.
That's
everything,
right.
And everything rides on Wonder Woman now.
And in addition to Wonder Woman, Ho-Ho Loon.
Ho-Ho Loon, of course. But like, and what, I mean, and you know, the lesson here that Warner Brothers should take is that they should just meddling. But Greg, you and I both know that won't be the case. And now that
no.
we know
and
that
the
every,
lesson they'll take from this will be meddle even
meddle
more.
Even more, because now that everything rides on Wonder Woman, I feel sorry for Patty Jenkins, the director, because I would imagine at this point that the movie essentially is not going to be hers from here on out. She's just going to have to cross her fingers and hope that what she's done thus far is to Warner Brothers' liking, because otherwise they've proven it. They'll take your movie and they'll hack it to shreds.
Let me tell you what we better not get. Better not get Wonder Woman movie where she spends the whole movie dropping one-liners. Because that's not Diana.
Nope.
We better not get a Wonder Woman movie where she broods the entire movie.
Because that's,
Diana,
not Diana.
Yeah. I think that with the exception of the fringe, of the vocal minority of the internet that will never be satisfied with anything, I think what fans of these characters, all that we want is for these characters to be treated with respect.
Right.
It's for these characters
and
to be
at least somewhat recognizable.
Right.
In terms
because
of being adaptations of their comic book counterparts.
I'm all about doing your own we just talked about Chris Nolan doing his own thing. Here's the thing. Marvel movies have been successful. And Fox movies now with Deadpool and Wolverine have been successful by taking the characters off of the comic book page and just presenting those characters on the big screen.
Capturing the essence of who those characters are.
Yeah.
Tinker with the origin here and there. Tinker with the story. Tinker with the visual look. But the essence and the core of those characters remains intact.
And here's one last parting shot before we move on to our close here. Nick, I saw this on the internet as well. I'm not going to take credit for this. But do you think it would be unfair to say that the best Joker on the big screen this year was Jesse Eisenberg?
actually, it would be unfair, Greg. And let me tell you why, as you can attest to that I can't, because I haven't seen the movie yet, would the best Joker on the big screen this far this year not be the man himself, Mr. Mark Hamill?
Mark Hamill, yes, absolutely. You are correct. Live action Joker, then. Let me go there. Oh, my Lord. So we've had – in this year, we've had Lex Luthor played as the Joker, and we've had the Joker played as Carmine Falcone, essentially.
Like a dog.
Like a dog. Begged. Like a dog. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, this brings to a close our Suicide Squad review. We apologize for any spoilers we may have had in there. I don't think that we had anything too bad.
There's nothing to spoil!
No, it's that not much happened in this movie of interest. And listen, that being said, this was just our take on the movie.
Yeah.
Go to placetobenation.com/comics. If you disagree with us, tell us. Tell us why you enjoyed it, what you enjoyed about it.
That would be something I would be intrigued to hear, because I've heard people say they liked it, and they haven't the people that I've come across haven't really given me a reason for why they liked it.
Yeah, most of what I've been able to gather is people who have enjoyed this movie primarily enjoyed it because they got to see these characters on the screen.
Right.
Like, for a lot of girls, they've wanted to see – I shouldn't say girls. A lot of guys too have always just wanted to see Harley on the big screen, and they really like that. They really like Deadshot, things like that. But hey, to each their own. My counter to that would be I want to see these characters – in a story that does them justice, and I don't think that this one really did. I also saw some people think the movie was just had a sense of doing something different. I would argue it really didn't do that much different. I would argue that the plot was paint by the numbers, what plot there was. The climax movie was literally any action movie that you've pretty much ever seen.
It was a movie that wasn't nearly as witty or funny or different as David Ayer probably thought it was while he was writing it.
Complete with, in the climactic fight scene, the corniest usage of slow-mo. People can rag on Zack Snyder all they want to. He has never had a cornier slow-motion scene than the one at the end of this movie. I won't spoil it. You'll see it when it happens. It is cringeworthy. Absolutely cringeworthy. But that's the nature of the beast. That's the nature of the situation we find ourselves in. If you disagree, let us know on the Facebook page. Tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Let us know your thoughts on this episode of Hard Traveling Fanboys. Let us know your thoughts on Suicide Squad. And we've got some pretty big stuff coming up on the horizon. What do we have coming the people's way, Nick?
Absolutely. So next week, we're going to be digging back into our long boxes for another edition of The Long Book Hunters, where we're going to be taking a look at Kieran Gillen's indie series, The Wicked and the Divine, which I read a few months back. Greg has not read as of yet. So it'll be interesting to get that, take a look at that one. In 2 weeks' time, we've got another edition of Countdown coming, in which we will be inviting back, the walking Marvel encyclopedia himself, Mr. Tim Capel. And in that countdown, we'll be counting down our top five Marvel crossover events, which should be very interesting, given both of your histories with early 90s Marvel and particularly the X-Men.
Yes.
And my experience with some more 2000s Marvel. And particularly the Ultimate Universe.
Ultimatum has got to be on your list.
Ultimatum would not make a list of my top toilet paper that I use to wipe my ass. Thank you very much. In any event, so that's coming up in 2 weeks' time. And then next month, and I can't remember the exact week, but I know that coming next month, as we have promised, will be the debut of Hard Travelers for Hire, in which we're going to start our chronological rewatch of the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe, beginning, of course, with the movie that started it all, 2008's Iron Man. We're going to go in-depth on that film to about, what it was like in the build-up to it, what our memories of it are, and, of course, the legacy, the indelible legacy that it has left behind.
Yes, and we will also be engaging in a much-anticipated hard-traveling debate as we debate the Obadiah Stane character in the movie. This should be a fun one. And also, I want to let people know, you can obviously hear the sultry, some would say sexy, sensual tones of Nick and I every week here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast. We also have some big guests coming up, though. We mentioned that Tim's going to be returning. Tim, one of our most popular guests. We also have Jennifer Smith returning here in a couple months to talk Walking Dead with us. We have Joseph Stone, who will make his debut as a guest on the Hard Traveling Fanboys to talk about Walking Dead. And I believe next month, Nick, or maybe later this month, the illustrious, the malevolent, the powerful Ben Morse
yes.
will be joining us for the first time ever.
In September, yes. As I mentioned, we have Tim slated for our next countdown, which is Top Marvel Events. Also events, but then in September, we're going to do another Marvel-themed countdown, which will be the top Marvel video games of all time, and Ben Morse, the editor of Marvel.com, will be joining us for that one. So,
absolutely.
Very excited about that, you know, and then, of course, we've also got something else coming up in September that, Curiouser and
curiouser.
Something, folks, that once you listen to it will make you say, oh dear.
Folks, we mentioned earlier the term balling too ugly. Now, this is going to be, quite frankly, folks, this is going to be Great Khali versus Prince Albert ugly. This is going to be, for God's sake, for lack of a better term, this is going to be Black Rain ugly. This is going to be TNA in the Destination America era ugly, quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen.
It's going to be an interesting sit, but like I said, well, that's all coming up in September, so be sure to check us out over the next couple of months. We've got some interesting things lined up your way. Be sure to check out the other podcasts here on Place to Be Nation Pop, you know, the Seller's Points, Todd Weber's Conversation Comics, which, if I'm not mistaken, the most recent edition of that has a real-life comic book artist on it. To my knowledge, that is the first creator we've nailed down for any of our Place to Be Nation Pop comic books.
The first of many, as I am attempting to get Peter David here on the podcast to
Something tells me, Greg, you better get that in the next couple of weeks, because after September, I don't think that he'll be on speaking terms with Place to Be Nation Pop anymore.
Indeed. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we really, really hope that you enjoyed this episode more than we enjoyed the movie. We will be back with you next week, as always, and read some comics, watch some comic movies, do something comic-related this week. And get back to us on the Facebook page. We will catch you next week. Have a good one.